This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm speaking to you in English. I know that's really obvious, but I point it out because English is not only the predominant language spoken in Vermont, it's a dominant language globally. Why English is so dominant has a lot to do with colonialism, power, continued economic prowess, and now the ease of travel and the infiltration of technology to what once might have been far reaches of the world. But as English and other dominant languages like Spanish and French continue to be the language of commerce in many countries around the world, other languages are being pushed out. If you want to go to school in many countries, you're going to need to speak the common language. Ditto if you want to work in business. And sometimes there are more subtle forces at play, an active push by a colonizing power to get rid of native language and culture, or the desire of native speakers to assimilate, to gain social status, or to hide an ancestral identity. Today on the show, we're going to go deeper into why languages decline and sometimes go extinct. We'll talk about examples of where speakers of endangered languages are fighting to preserve their words, and we'll learn about what's lost when a language dies. We're joined in the studio today by Emily Mineta, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Vermont. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
So can you just describe, I don't mean culturally, but sort of definitionally, what it means for a language to be endangered?
Yeah, when we think about a language becoming endangered, we think about the breakdown in a process by which children acquire their native languages from their parents. And in a situation where a language is becoming under increasing pressure, that kind of handing down of the native language is becoming less and less common. So within the household, we're thinking about maybe only older generations controlling the language and children no longer learning or acquiring the native language of their parents or their grandparents. So that begins the process of a language becoming endangered.
And extinct? I mean, that's just what it sounds like.
Ultimately, we think of a language becoming extinct when there are no living native speakers any longer. But, you know, before that happens, there's this kind of transition where those native speakers do become older and older, and you see the loss of community, right? So there's no one to talk to on a daily basis using the language.
And a language is considered extinct even if some linguists have preserved the words and the language's structure, the grammatical structure.
Sure. I mean, we can imagine many languages that we know about. I mean, even think about historical languages that we study, like ancient Hebrew or Latin. Those are languages that aren't spoken by large native-speaking communities, with a few kind of cute exceptions. But they are languages that we study, we know a lot about, that we're very interested in. So languages around the world can be documented, and we can have dictionaries and grammars and materials. But that's not the same thing as having a living speaking community.
So how fast are languages dying out right now?
The change for linguists, the change is marked and alarming. We actually see a vastly increased rate of language endangerment and language extinction to the point where, as you mentioned at the top of your program, that we're really expecting over our lifetimes to see losses that are perhaps half of the languages that are spoken on the planet today. That's pretty stunning if you step back and think about it.
And that's different than what it used to be? It's a much faster rate of decline?
I mean, we assume that languages have always fallen out of existence, right? Human languages are linked to human communities. And as a community is overtaken or spreads out, you know, then we assume that languages were lost sporadically and periodically and perhaps more rapidly in times of, let's say, great empire expansion, right? But this change that we're seeing is unprecedented in its scope and its speed and its scale and it's increasing.
All right. So about half of the world's languages could be gone by the end of the century. That's about 6,500 languages left spoken today. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from one of the last remaining Abenaki speakers. And yes, he will explain why it's actually pronounced Abenaki. You're probably more familiar with Abenaki. But if you have a question about other languages or why they're disappearing so quickly and how linguists determine when a language is dead as opposed to one that's just morphed and changed as all speech and language does, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Professor Mineta, let's get into why. You say right now we're seeing this rapid decline that's marked and alarming. Why right now are languages declining so much more quickly?
Well, you know, I think the changes that are happening all over the globe are something that we can all recognize and feel on an individual basis. We know that, you know, from the beginning of the colonial period on, that native languages of continents such as North America came under severe pressure. Not just languages, though. Let's think about those communities themselves, right? Those communities were being dominated, in some cases actually wiped out by those colonial forces. And then subsequent to that, what we see is unprecedented levels of political and economic pressure on those dwindling communities and their dwindling resources. And then on top of this, we see globalization. We see an increase in the spread of dominant language media, dominant language education, as you mentioned, so that when a child comes into the world as a native speaker of an endangered language of North America, for instance, they're not likely to feel that being a speaker of that language is a sort of valuable commodity that's going to help move them forward in the world. One of the things that activists for endangered languages are doing to combat this sense is trying to tie that native language not just to its economic value, but instead to its value as a way of someone to express their identity and to feel a linkage with their heritage or their community. But, you know, that pressure from globalization and from sort of more global economic systems favors dominant, large, widely spoken languages categorically over local home languages that have sort of a limited scope of use.
Is it always a sort of an oppressive system or an oppressive language that's coming in and dominating that native language? Or is it sometimes perhaps no less of a loss, but a little bit more benign, an influence? You know, you mentioned that, you know, the economic forces come in. And so in the case of the United States, English is obviously the dominant language right now here in this country. And the language of commerce is in English. Most of the language of education is in English. And there's certainly a lot of colonial forces, so that's all tied in together. But are there sometimes times where I guess what I'm getting at is it feels like there's a judgment. So is there always a judgment that the dominant language is an oppressive language and that this less spoken native language or smaller language is somehow better to have there and being spoken?
Well, we kind of have to, I think, from a more abstract perspective, divorce these sort of feelings of this is an absolute bad thing or this is an absolute good thing. You know, someone who speaks an endangered language at home might be just as excited and just as happy to speak the dominant language because it connects them with their peers and with things that they find exciting. And that doesn't feel on the individual level, on the personal level, like they're being dominated, right? Or you know, oppressed in some specific way. But that just because we don't necessarily feel those forces at work in our individual lives doesn't mean that those forces aren't there. And that doesn't mean that the structure that causes us to abandon a native language or causes, indeed, a community to, say, no longer be able to support life in a rural space or no longer be able to support their families agriculturally living on the land and are forced to out-migrate to a major city. That doesn't mean that that process happens in the absence of processes that are set in motion that in which that person is caught unawares, right? And so I think those structures exist, and I think those structures are what have caused languages to come under such pressure. But that, you know, that may mean that an individual or community may not feel that sense of loss in such a negatively valued way as we might structure it, looking at it from the outside.
When a language is lost, is there always culture that is lost with it? Or do you see examples where culture is preserved minus a language structure?
I would say we have to be really careful about what we call culture in this case, right? Culture is not, as you know, right? It's not this solid, unitary thing, right? Like language, which is constantly changing, as you said, culture itself is constantly changing. Now, it's certainly the case that many people point out, you know, we have these wonderful examples of a single word that tells us something important about the natural world. And when that single word is lost and that speech community is lost, we lose that knowledge, So that's a form of culture that can be lost when a language is lost, right? We lose the ability to tell stories in that language and the ways in which we pass on information, the ways in which we structure that. Now, does that mean that that community that has lost that human language no longer has culture? No, of course not, right? No longer participates in culture, that individual who no longer speaks that language? No, that doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean that something has been lost? I think substantively so.
Listeners, I'd love for you to weigh in. Maybe you have some experience with this. Maybe you have a language back in your past that you don't speak anymore that perhaps your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents did. What do you think about it? What do you feel is lost when a language dies? And what questions do you have for Emily Mineta, UVM anthropology professor who's here with us today, helping us guide us through this discussion of dying and endangered languages? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, where I should point out, we also have on right on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, you can listen to what Goldilocks sounds like in Abenaki, also known around here as Abnaki, just to get a sense of that language we're going to hear coming up from a native speaker. So you might want to check out that page and listen to that very well-known fairy tale. We got a note from Allison who says, I studied this in Alaska, and I was able to see how the local Alaskan natives saw the earth and what their relationship with it was. It was a lot more intimate and personal than we white folks can possibly understand. The land and its connection with the people was inherent in the language. If you want to destroy a culture, a people, a way of life, forbid them from speaking it for three generations. By the time the third generation has returned home, the elders who spoke the language have died, and no one is there to pass the language on. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, I think that's actually pointing at something that we didn't or hadn't talked about, right? Which is we had sort of talked about when language attrition kind of happens in this natural process. But you have to remember that, you know, there is this horrible history in North America of compulsory boarding education for Native communities, which actually had as one of its explicit goals the erasure of that language over of just a single generation even. Children were physically punished, right, in many of these contexts, including in the Northeast, by both French and English language schools for using their native languages or the languages of their communities. And so, you know, let's be careful to point out that there are contexts like this listener is describing in Alaska where that loss was actually purposefully perpetrated by programs designed to eliminate these languages.
More to come. We're talking about dying and endangered languages with Emily Mineta, who's a UVM anthropologist. And coming up, we're going to hear from Jesse Bowman Bruchak, one of the last speakers of Abenaki left in the world, about the structure of this local native language and how he's trying to keep it alive. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, UVM anthropologist Emily Mineta is helping us understand why languages become extinct and what's lost when they do. We'd love your input, your thoughts. Maybe you have some family history with this that you'd like to share. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. What do you think is lost when a language dies? We want to spend a few minutes now looking at the Abenaki language. We actually learned last week that native speakers pronounce the word Abenaki, and that name has become anglicized over time. One of the few Abenaki speakers in the world is Jesse Bowman Bruchak of Saratoga Springs, New York. He's actually working in South Africa right now, but we Skyped with him on Friday to learn about his work in keeping the Abenaki language alive. Bruchak says his father was not a native speaker, but instead learned the language from others, as has Jesse. Jesse lived for nearly a decade at the Odinac community in Quebec, where he learned and taught the language with some of the last fluent speakers.
The problem is pretty much every year now we lose people because those who were speakers when I started were already in their 70s and 80s. The language was still paramount and spoken by pretty much everyone within the Odinac community, as well as several communities throughout New England, up until around the 1950s, right after World War II. It seemed there was a big shift. Television and other things came in, and people really started being more influenced by the dominant culture, and we saw the language's use diminish a lot.
Can you describe the structure of grammar and the structure of the language a little bit?
Yeah, unlike English, where we have a lot of little words like the and is and a, instead we have single words that will often come together to form an entire sentence. So, for example,